Listen to us now, live on the ESPN Chicago app. This is Chicago's home for sports, ESPN Chicago.
Brian Hanley hanging out with you here on ESPN 1000 inside the old National Bank studio. The Blackhawks lost their fourth straight last night against the Predators at home, 3-1. And they have, as I mentioned, lost four in a row. They won one game when they were in limbo. We talked about it last Sunday when they beat the Sharks. When Patrick Kane decided to go away and rethink the situation. And, of course, we all knew he was on his way to the New York Rangers. And it seems like the added benefit to subtracting Patrick Kane, your best player on your roster, has been that a team that was clearly tanking this year has now done everything they possibly can to, what's the opposite, Bri, of reinforce the roster?
Decimated?
Yes. Yeah. There you go. Well said. They've decimated the roster to a point where it seems like they're going to have trouble. It's only the Columbus Blue Jackets right now who have less points than the Blackhawks. So that bodes well for the tanking. Patrick Kane, though, discussed the trade yesterday and talked about, was asked specifically, hey, are you surprised that it came to this?
There's a bunch of different like steps along the way that probably led to it, but I think they're in a different situation now, right? They're rebuilding. They're trying to collect assets, and that's just the way it is. That's the situation we're in. So, you know, it's never really real until it happens, and then, you know, once it happens, it starts getting very real. But like I said, just excited for the experience, the opportunity, the chance to play with, you know, different organization, different players, and, yeah, just excited about it all.
So I know it's, I don't know what Hawks fans are doing. You would think they might want the Rangers to at least go to the Eastern Conference Finals so the Hawks could net an additional first rounder for Patrick Kane.
Conditional pick. They
exactly.
have to get to the conference finals for that to move up from second to first.
But I know a lot of Hawks fans hate the Rangers, too, so they don't really want to, for whatever reason, go down that route. But it looks like that's going to be a hard proposition if you watched any of yesterday's game, because the Bruins are just a machine, so they may stand in the way of the New York Rangers anyway, ultimately. It's a perfect opportunity to bring in Ben Pope of the Chicago Sun-Times. He covers the Hawks for the Sun-Times, and he joins us here on ESPN 1000. Ben, I have to imagine you can finally take a deep breath now that the NHL trade deadline has finally passed for the Hawks.
Yeah, for sure. It's been an exhausting few weeks. I'm actually, I think, a little bit sick today. I think it finally caught up with me, but at least it waited till after we got through Friday, so appreciative of that.
You know, as shocking, Ben, is the finality of Patrick Kane being moved is for Hawks fans and Hawks Nation and the franchise itself. You know, a couple of years ago, if you would told anybody that, and with Jonathan Toews maybe staring retirement in the face because of his health issues, if you would have told any of us that the net return for both those players would be what it seemingly is, we'd all be shocked. We thought the biggest question was, one, would either or both waive their no trade clause, and Patrick finally did it, and Jonathan Toews has got other issues. But we thought that would accelerate whatever rebuild the team would be in, and here you sit with not too much to show for it.
Yeah, that is the funny part, that when Kyle Davidson came in and announced this rebuild, you would assume that Kane and Toews would have been the two biggest assets to sell off to really accelerate things, but that is definitely not ended up being the case. I'm not sure it's really his fault. It's just the situation didn't really transpire in a way that worked out for that aim. Kane pretty much said it was the Rangers or nothing. And so with the Hawks sort of obligated to fulfill his wishes, but also not really having any alternatives, they were kind of at the whims of the Rangers and what they wanted to offer. So you could arguably even say that it's surprising they got as much as they did, a second and a fourth, with the potential for the second to become a first. And then obviously Toews, there's nothing they could do either with him not currently playing, doesn't really have any trade value. So definitely surprising to see how it panned out, even though it's just kind of unfortunate circumstances. But at least they have been able to get some other first-round picks and high assets for other players that maybe you wouldn't necessarily have thought of right off of the bat.
Ben Pope of the Chicago Sun-Times joining us here talking Hawks. Meller and Hanley on ESPN 1000. Ben, do you feel like, from what you've been able to glean, do you think Kyle Davidson did his best to force Patrick Kane's hand? Because that no-movement clause made it into a situation where the Hawks were at Kane's will. Do you think he made it uncomfortable for Patrick Kane to want to come back?
Yeah, that's always really the big question here. I don't think he did anything specifically or directly to force him out, but you can obviously make the argument that a couple of things he did do might have influenced that or tried to sort of lead him in that direction, and that being that they've pretty much gutted the roster around him. They got rid of DeBrinket and Strome last summer, who were his line mates all of last season, and his closest friends still left in the team other than Taves. And obviously a bunch of other key players as well to make this season as bad as possible. And then also it sounds like they probably weren't interested in re-signing him this summer, which would probably be another reason why Kane might want to just go ahead and get a head start somewhere else. So I don't think he did anything specifically to force him out. I think that'd be an exaggeration, but there obviously were factors that probably influenced Kane to end up leaving. I don't think that it was just that he wanted out of town desperately.
Ben, when you hear from Hawks fans on social media and just around the United Center, how's this being received? And Kyle Davidson, like Ryan Poles, has been very transparent and seemingly very honest when he talks to the media. He wouldn't put a timeline on this rebuild. And we all know now what this team, now you tweeted out, basically this could be the worst Hawks team in the history of Hawks teams, I'm paraphrasing. When you listed the starters on this team now, what does the future look like? I mean, is this 3 years of hold your nose? Is it 4 or 5? Do you have any idea where this goes and how quickly it gets there?
Well, when Davidson was named the permanent GM last March, so a year ago, he roughly said 3 to 5 years would be a good estimate. So we're a year in, so that puts it at 2 to 4, and I think that still makes sense. It obviously depends on how well the players that they draft develop and how quickly they do, and also a bit of the draft lottery luck. If they get the number 1 overall pick this year and get Connor Bedard, that probably accelerates things quite a bit. I think it's understandable why he doesn't really have a specific timeline considering how many unknowns there are. But it certainly would be shocking to see them contending next year. I think that they might not be outright tanking again to this degree, but it's definitely going to be another transition year of a lot of placeholders filling up the roster and maybe just a few prospects starting to trickle into full-time NHL status, not really the next generation by any means. And then the year after that, depending on how things go, it might become kind of a younger group and we'll start to see what the core of the future is going to be, but it could take some time to develop chemistry and experience and learn how to win in the league. So I think the 2 to 4 years, 3 to 4 years timeline kind of makes the most sense here if it all goes well.
Ben Pope covers the Hawks for the Chicago Sun-Times. Jeff Miller, Brian Hanley with you until 11 o'clock today. Ben, how would you assess how Kyle Davidson did in regards to all the trades he made? If you had to give him maybe a grade, he obviously moves Max Domi, Sam Lafferty, Jake McCabe, in addition to Kane, primarily for draft picks. What's your assessment of how he did at this trade deadline?
I'd probably give him a B, to be fair. I think the Kane situation is kind of on its own. He actually kind of described it as that is a totally separate deal from everything else. But his other 8 trades, although some of which were just kind of minor swaps, I think were pretty much right on expectations. He got a first-round pick for Jake McCabe with salary retained. He got a second-round pick for Sam Lafferty. He got a second-round pick for Max Domi. I think those are pretty much what we expected a month ago. That would be roughly the fair market value for those guys. So he hit them on the nose, not above, not below. So I think a B grade is fair here. The only maybe surprises were that Andreas Athanasiou, who was also signed last summer to a 1-year deal, wasn't moved. And then maybe that someone like Jack Johnson netted an actual NHL player in return, or that they were able to bring in 2 draft picks for taking on Zaitsev's contract. That Zaitsev trade with Ottawa might have been the best of the group. So I think, yeah, it was fairly successful, not mind-blowing, but you could be fairly satisfied with how they did.
you know, Jeff just mentioned that they've lost four in a row, but they had won five in a row. And some people are really, you know, stop that. You're not supposed to be winning. But Luke Richardson, from the outside looking in, seemingly is a competent, capable man behind the bench. You've been around him a little bit now. What's your take on the the first year of the Blackhawks head coach?
Yeah, I think it's been probably the brightest part of the season is the impression that Richardson has made. He's really knocked it out of the park in every regard, going from his systems and the strategies he's put in to kind of get the most out of a very undermanned team, to the communication he's put in place. The locker room culture has seemed pretty healthy this year in spite of all the demoralization and just everything else. He has a good coaching staff around him. He seems to handle things pretty calmly and not lose his head over anything. He's been very impressive this season, and that's probably got to be the most exciting, optimism-inducing part of all of this is that it does seem like the Blackhawks have found a very strong coach that can lead this rebuild long-term. Obviously, as expectations rise, it might not be quite so easy to exceed the expectations. That's just kind of how it works for both Richardson and Davidson. But so far, it's been really encouraging signs.
Ben Pope joining us here on ESPN 1000. Ben, I was asked on Friday night how many years Seth Jones has remaining on his contract, and I said 20. Obviously, I think it's 7, if I'm not mistaken. Right now, we look at this Blackhawks roster, and I have to be honest. They're just, for a Chicago sports fan, they are no longer must-see. It is clearly, if they're on, I will put them on a cursory TV. And
you're a Hawks fan.
I am. No, you're right, Bri. And I'm probably in the minority of Chicago sports fans. But for me, they've become, okay, I'll put them on if there's nothing else that's intriguing to me. And I have three TVs in my basement. So that's how I work the Hawks these days. Who has currently been on the roster? And I guess we'll go ahead and say Lucas Reichel's on the roster. Who on the roster right now is a top six forward or a top four defenseman for this, you know, for the next time the Blackhawks are a contender?
Yeah, that's a question that's been talked about a lot lately, I feel like. And you are right, there are not many. I think Reichel is almost a sure thing. He's looked really good his past few call-ups. He's only 21 years old, so... he has a very bright future. I think you can definitely pin him in. I think Seth Jones, he hasn't been bad this year. He's maybe not a number one defenseman, but he's definitely the best defenseman on this team. And it wouldn't be surprising to see him still playing at a top pairing or top two pairing level in a couple years when they're trying to contend again. It does seem like he's probably the most likely to be here just because it would be so difficult to move him. And they do kind of need this contract to even get to the salary floor next year. So just makes sense for all sides for him to stay. And then beyond that, there's not really any sure things. I think you look at Philip Kurashev and Taylor Radish. Both those guys have been decently productive this year. Both of them are 23, 24, so on the younger side. So I think there's a decent chance that one or two of them manage to stick around for the next two or three years, but they're not going to be integral pieces of that team. If they do, they'll probably be maybe like third line sort of secondary contributors, but they would probably be the other two. I mean, there's a bunch of guys in Rockford, particularly on defense, that have promise and could end up forming part of the next defensive core, but they haven't really, aside from a few occasional call-ups, really promoted to the NHL yet. So not a lot of guys really worth paying attention to on this roster as far as guys who could stick around until they're relevant again.
Well, Ben, we'll let you go, but last night I looked, you know, that it was minus 250 on Nashville on the money line over the Hawks, and if you didn't want to, you know, stomach that, I bet the under is defense, and you just spoke about Luke Richardson, you know, culture, want to, you can get that effort on defense, whether they're, you know, but I don't know where the scoring's going to come from here on out, and you know, who cares because you're on Connor Bedard, but it's going to be the last 20 games. They might be hard pressed to get 20 goals.
Yeah, the scoring is going to be tough. Seth Jones is their leading scorer now with 28 points on the season, which is just comical. Domi had 49 before they traded him, so you get a sense of how much production they lost. So Yeah, I don't think we're going to see or hear Chelsea Dagger too much the rest of the way, but it's kind of the idea, so I guess it's not to be surprised.
Ben, one last thing as we let you go, because I do want to ask you about this, because this is where I'm at as a Hawks fan. During this entire segment, I've been on tankathon.com, the NHL version, and I've been simulating a lottery for the Blackhawks, and I've yet to win. I've probably hit it 20 times now. You know, they have, again, the second worst record in the league currently, but that would only give them a 13.5% chance at the number one overall pick. If they could jump Columbus, that would increase their odds to 25.5%. What happens, though? I mean, because really it's been all about potentially Connor Bedard. His name's been said in conjunction with the Hawks probably more than anybody except Patrick Kane this season when we talk about the Blackhawks. What happens if, unfortunately, the stone-cold numbers play out and the Hawks don't end up with either the top pick or, you know, a lot of people do like Fantilli, but if they don't end up with a top two pick, what then happens with the Hawks?
Yeah, that would definitely be an unfortunate scenario, and I think statistically is the most likely, even if they finish in last. I think it's just about 50% that they would fall to third, but I think the fact that they couldn't fall further than third in that situation is still a pretty appealing part of finishing last, because Leo Carlson, he's a Swedish prospect, has really rocketed up the draft boards this year and has established himself as kind of the third elite prospect in this draft class. He's not maybe on the level of Bedard or Fantilli, but he probably could have been the number one pick last year, just considering how strong this year is compared to others. So I think he would be a pretty solid consolation prize. There's also the Matvei Michkov question, who talent-wise is probably on par with Fantilli and Carlson, but just the issue of that he's under contract in Russia for several more years, and there's just some unknowns with that, but they'll still have some encouraging options if they fall to third, but obviously that would probably set things back a little bit, not having an instant superstar that you probably would if you got Bedard or Fantilli.
Good stuff, Ben. Thanks for hopping on. We appreciate it, man.
Yep, thanks for having me.
That is Ben Pope of the Chicago Sun-Times joining us on the CarX Tire and Auto Hotline. Boy, oh boy, Bri, I'm just, you know.
You mentioned it. It's like, it was like me during the real down years for the Cubs. I couldn't sit through three innings, let alone 3 hours of baseball. And you, like you said, you have nothing else is on. You have three TVs. You might turn them on. The Bulls are getting to that point. And, you know, it's like 2 years ago with the White Sox. 3 years ago, we were all watching what was going on in the minor leagues. So we were more interested in watching those games, Birmingham games, than the actual White Sox games.
No, baseball can't get here quick enough because the winter tenants at the UC have really made it not as much fun. Like, as casual, you know, I don't know if you're a casual sports fan, if you're just somebody who watches, you know, the teams in the city. I personally I'm looking for other NBA games. I'm looking for other NHL games, because the Bulls and the Hawks are just tough to watch these days. And like we just, you know, went over with Ben there. There's not even a whole lot on the Hawks roster that you can look at, and you have to squint your eyes and say, okay, maybe, but it's not great right now for the
Hey, at least with the Bulls, you can watch Patrick Beverley yell at Vooch and, you know, get him upset.
I guess. How often does Kevin Durant come into the as the visitor? I need more of that to make me interested. 312-332-3776. Are you watching? What are you watching these days? Are you still compelled to watch the Hawks and the Bulls? You mentioned baseball there. Let's dive into the pitch clock. We've now had a full week to kind of digest it. And in addition to that, the Cubs were dealt a injury blow that I think you and I kind of saw coming. We'll talk about that next here on ESPN 1000.
This is Chicago's home for sports. ESPN Chicago. Listen now in HD on our app and on ESPN 1000.
One of the worst parts about the job, when you have to share the news of a beloved colleague passing, longtime member of this radio station, Dave Wills. He He was.
Oh, Jesus.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean Brian. I didn't want to blindside you there, but I literally just saw it. And Dave Wills, Willsy, as he was affectionately known, did pre and post game here on ESPN Chicago for, I think it was 11 years. I worked with Dave Wills for, I'm trying to think now, probably 3 or 4 years when I first started in this business as his producer. He did White Sox pre and post here on ESPN 1000 up until I believe it was 2004 when he then left to go become the play-by-play man for the Tampa Bay Rays, where he has spent the last 18 seasons. He died early this morning, according to the team. Dave Wills, you know, local guy, grew up in Chicago.
Just a great guy.
Dude, I loved Willsy. He was, again, my introduction to this business in a lot of ways.
Just, I mean, a pro's pro behind the mic, but just one of the most affable, just genuine humans in our business. And good Lord, we've lost a lot of them in the last few years. But, I mean, I saw, you know, he tweeted out a few weeks ago thanking the Tampa medical staff for helping him. And it seemed like he was on the mend from a very serious situation. But, I mean, good Lord. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, we signed off, and I'm getting a text that Lynn Bramer passed. And, I mean, people like that, you know, Lynn used to always say, take nothing for granted. It's great to be alive. And just when you lose talent, it's one thing. When you lose just wonderful human beings, it takes it to a whole different. What a gut punch.
Yeah. Like I said, I worked with Wills, you know, for probably 3 or 4 years when I was first starting out as a producer here at ESPN 1000. And he was just, you know, any White Sox fan will tell you, he was the passionate Southsider who, you know, his voice behind the mic when White Sox were winning or losing games, it was so authentic. And he left for his dream gig to be the play-by-play man of the Tampa Bay Rays. And, you know, he was obviously very successful there for the past 18 years. I know he had made a home there in Tampa and was beloved by Rays fans. And just, yeah, just a heck of a bummer, man. Again, Dave Wills passes away today. 58, tough loss here in the city of Chicago. Again, one of Chicago's own, did pre and post for the White Sox for 11 years here at ESPN 1000. So just you know, and we're celebrating our 25th anniversary. Dave Wills, I definitely know, helped really familiarize people with this radio station way back in the day. So,
and you said you can't fake that passion. There's a reason that people who grew up in this town aspire to stay in this town and talk sports and be, you know, broadcast, print, whatever, because it's part of your DNA. And you're a fan first and foremost, but you're a professional. And Dave is just, I mean, just so genuine and so approachable and so affable and so good. And at 58 years old, too damn young.
I can't remember how many nights I would spend back here, you know, right as soon as the game would hit, Dave would wrap up the pregame.
Yep.
And then we'd go grab some sandwiches from Potbelly or something, and then nestle in with him and Melty, Bill Melton, to do you know, get settled in for postgame coverage of White Sox games. So just devastating news. Dave Wills, again, lost far too young at the age of 58 this morning. Let's try Owen in Willowbrook. Hey, Owen, you're on ESPN 1000 with Meller and Hanley.
Hey, guys, I'm really sorry about the loss of your good friend, because I can remember Dave Wells was one of the first guys I used to call him to after the postgame shows, and he just did a great job. He was really, truly a great White Sox fan. In fact, I got to say, you know, when he left the Sox, I think he went on to become an announcer for Tampa Bay,
correct,
didn't he?
Yep, the play-by-play man. Yep. Yeah,
18 years.
Yeah.
I mean, Owen, I don't mean to interrupt you, but the one thing, that's why he left. Like, I can't imagine Willsy would have left. You know, he was a diehard White Sox fan, grew up on the South Side, loved them, and that passion always came through on the radio, but he got his dream gig to be a play-by-play man for the Rays, so he kind of had to take it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think that would have been the only reason he would have gone, because obviously he was going to become an announcer for Major League team, and how do you pass that up? But, I mean, he really knew the game.
Oh, yeah.
He knew the game, and he was really passionate about the Sox. But am I wrong? I thought he was. Did he leave before the World Series year?
So that was at Dolan. That's the year he left. So he was here until 2004, and then Brian Dalgan took over the pre and post game duties in 2005 when the White Sox did win it. Of course, you mentioned, like, you know, John Rooney and Ed Farmer were entrenched in the booth, you know, for all the White Sox calls, and especially when they won the World Series there. So that's you know. Dave saw an opportunity and he couldn't pass it up. So just
there's only a handful of those jobs, and you have to, you know, you have to take one of them if they become available. So
he was passionate about the game, but one thing I really liked about it was, you know, I mean, if things didn't go right, he'd say that, you know. I mean, it wasn't just he wasn't a homer, and I mean he loved the Sox, but he knew the game, he understood the game, and it's a great loss. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, thank you all. I appreciate the call. Thanks for sharing your memories. Yeah, and I don't know if Dolan mentioned it, but it said on the screen too. Wilsey, great pipes, Bry. I mean, unmistakable. He clearly was born to be a play-by-play man. And so,
we'll talk about a baritone. I mean, just talk about just this deep and I mean, it's just another gut punch. And there've been too many of them for too many young still. In the prime of their life, guys that we've, you know, known forever, and then guys like Joe Goddard, we always call him young Joe Goddard because he didn't seem to age, and he passed a few weeks ago, the former baseball scribe for the Sun-Times, who I worked side by side with forever. But, you know, this one just catches off guard. I know that he was battling, and he was hopefully turning the corner and getting his health back, and you know, it just... It's just gut-wrenching.
And I think anybody who knew Wilsey, and I know, you know, White Sox fans who went to games in, you know, in the early, mid-90s into the early 2000s, like when he would do pre and post from the park, you know, he was like a man of the people, you know. So I think anybody who's a longtime White Sox fan just remembered Dave Wills. He was giving you...
So approachable.
Yes. I mean, he would have a beer with you whenever the opportunity arose. And
I mean, I covered the White Sox for a couple seasons, and just to sit up in the Bards room with, you know, so many... I mean, the fun of that job, I mean, sitting there getting paid to watch baseball, whatever sport I was covering at the time. But the great thing about our profession, you're not going to the same place, sitting in the same cubicle, doing the same thing every day. You never know what that day is going to bring, who you might meet that you've never met before, who you might share a meal with, share laughs with, and certainly the opportunity to do that with Dave many, many times. I mean, it seems like it was yesterday, and it wasn't. But
yep, so we will try and sojourn on here. We're here till 11. I'm Jeff Meller. He's Brian Hanley. Again, tough news, Dave Wills, longtime broadcaster, play-by-play man for the Tampa Bay Rays, and longtime pre- and post-game host here on ESPN 1000 for the Chicago White Sox, passes away today, this morning, at the age of 58. We'll be right back.
Follow Chicago's Home for Sports on Twitter at ESPN 1000. This is Chicago's Home for Sports, ESPN Chicago.
Jeff Meller, Brian Hanley hanging out with you here on this Sunday morning, bright, sunshiny morning. Soak up that vitamin D. Brian.
You would take this for opening day, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would think so. Definitely.
I mean, we've sat through some snow showers on opening day here in Chicago, so, I mean, it might not be as warm as you'd like, but the sun's out. That's a good start.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, I'm trying to look here. Officially, I don't have my... I know it's like the... Is it the 30th? The 29th? The 30th is opening day? I'm trying to remember now. Yeah, I believe it's, right? The 30th,
yep.
I believe.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Thursday, March 30th is opening day for baseball this season. So, we'll see how the weather is. Hopefully, I think you're right. We would take this. Maybe 10 degrees warmer would be ideal if we could pick it, right? But this would certainly suffice, I would say. Any reaction, Bry, to the fact, now that we've had a kind of a week to take it in a little bit, any more reaction to the pitch clock after having an opportunity to kind of soak it in and see if you've figured anything out? Do you think the teams will adapt quickly here?
Yeah, I mean, yesterday the White Sox, it was 2 hours and 40-some minutes, and they I know a couple of the stories where, like, well, it seemed like a long game because they've been averaging about 2.5 hours. The White Sox have actually been ahead of the average by 7 or 8 minutes. So it's, hey, everyone's fallen in love with it. And it, what it seems like the players are adapting as quickly as you might have hoped, or even quicker than you might have anticipated. And even the veterans, you know, seemed like all players were, the majority of players were against this radical idea. And within a week, a little over a week of spring training games, they're like, yeah, this works, like the pace of the game. And some of the pitchers who like to work quickly anyway are like, yeah, good. You know, it doesn't change my world, but it changes the baseball world. And so far, so good.
Yeah, I'm not even worried so much about the time of game, although it certainly helps. But it's, for me, it's just, hey,
the pace.
Yes. I like the problem with baseball. And it's one of those things where it was broken. And it had declined, but it had done so slowly, gradually, right? And so I don't think people even recognized how bad it had gotten in some ways. Like, it was just, okay, if you're a baseball fan, this is what you're accustomed to. And maybe for some people, too, the distraction of having, you know, social media open while you're watching a baseball game, like coinciding with the fact that baseball games were taking longer and the pace of play was slowing down, maybe people didn't notice it as much. But I love the fact that now I can keep my eyes on the game and, you know, all of a sudden I don't have to find a distraction to kind of occupy my mind. I can, okay, there's some, we're moving here. You know, you got 15 seconds and batter, get your eyes on the pitcher within 8. And all of a sudden we can watch, you know, some baseball. I think that one of my takeaways is I think it's actually going to be more of an issue for hitters as they, because I think pitchers will adjust. Maybe the big hard throwing relievers who rely on reloading and kind of, reloading and figuring it, you know, so that they can give full effort. It might be problematic for them, but I think for hitters, if you saw, I don't know, there was a video going around of Max Scherzer really messing around with the pitch clock. One of the hitters for the Nationals, I believe Adams, called timeout, and you only get one per plate appearance now, right? So yep. He called his timeout because Scherzer was kind of throwing him off being ready on the mound. And so he called his timeout. Scherzer then did not step off the rubber. Then when Adams kind of reacclimated himself, got into the box, as soon as he had his eyes up and ready to go on Scherzer, Scherzer's firing and got him on a strikeout. And I think good pitchers are going to be able to use this to their advantage against hitters who are going to, that's for them, going to be a huge adjustment where you have to be ready to go when you get into the box.
Yeah, and you have 30 seconds between batters too. So it's not, look, I don't know how many times you sit there and watch a guy adjust his batting gloves, like, you know, he's going into surgery and he needed, you know, you don't need any of that. And he's got one hand up to the umpire's face. I got time and I'm got to do this. You get rid of all that stuff. And maybe, you know, your walk-up music has to be a lot quicker or whatever. It's so far the pace is great. And, I think Tanner Banks asked Daryl Van Schouwen of the Sun-Times, who covers the White Sox, mm-hmm. Hey, what do you think this is going to do to concession sales? You know, will the owners be upset because it's 2.5 hours instead of 3.5 hours and they're not selling as many $14 beers? I don't know about the like the beer cup snakes out in the bleachers. I mean, how quickly do you have to build those now? Do you got to start drinking in the first 3 innings to get that going? I don't know.
Listen, it's a fascinating question because there's no doubt, it's undeniable, they will lose some revenue that they previously got. Of course, beer sales cut off in the 7th inning.
Sure.
So, but, you know, obviously you'll be getting to that 7th inning quicker than you usually will. So there will be some revenue lost. I think the hope is, though, that
They're expanding the fan base.
Yeah, the interest in the game might create more revenue streams, you know, and bigger, more lucrative television contracts down the road. I'll be curious to see when the season wraps up if we will get some reports, if somebody will leak some information about how much money your average team lost, right? Like, because those are numbers that they never open the books and they don't want to, right? Like,
you might have more eyes actually on the product. You might have better ratings because you're not sitting there slogging through 3 hours plus of no action. Now, it's not going to necessarily increase the action of the game, you know, in terms of getting guys on. They're hoping bigger bases will increase stolen bases and movement that way. And, you know, obviously abandoning or outlawing the shift. they hope creates more balls in play and more opportunities for offense. But the biggest thing so far of the changes, obviously, has been the pitch clock. And I haven't heard anyone really complain about it. And you know, I'm old school. I thought I wasn't going to be thrilled with it. But, you know, it worked very well in the minor leagues. And it seemingly is working very well in the first 10 days or so here.
Yeah. Now, one guy who won't have an opportunity to adjust and acclimate to the new pitch clock, at least not through spring training, it looks like, is Seiya Suzuki, who is dealing with the oblique injury. And you and I joked when we saw the picture a couple of weeks ago of him showing up to spring training, having added, quote, whatever it was, 25 plus pounds of, you know, muscle.
Yeah, but, muscle.
Yeah, we looked at it and we were like, yeah, that doesn't look like somebody who has put on the ideal weight. And sure enough, you know, before you even get going, Seiya Suzuki is scratched, and now he's dealing with an oblique injury, which, by the way, Bri, I know you've watched and covered baseball for a long, long time. Oblique injury, one of the worst in baseball.
Yeah. Everything you do, I mean, if it, you know, you're going to feel it, and I don't know if you could even feel his oblique given that extra weight he put on.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, the idea that you've got training camp invitees now going to, you know, battle for his position out in the outfield doesn't exactly spell contending team to me. But obviously, at the minimum, he's going to miss the start of the season. It's just a matter of how much of the season he's going to miss, you know, going forward, because he was early on in camp putting on some home run hitting shows and just, you know, in batting practice. But as long as he can still recruit Ohtani when he needs to be talked to, I'm good. As long as he can still do that and make the sales pitch to come to Wrigley, I'll be good with that.
Listen, I think you can recruit him if you can get Tom Ricketts to agree to pay a $600 million contract. I mean, there's no question it seems like everything I'm reading, all the reports, he's going to get $500 million.
Oh, yeah.
The question is some team going,
more?
Yeah, is a team like the Dodgers going to want him so badly that they'll be willing to push it to $600 million? And again, we went over it a little bit a few weeks ago, but he comes with, you know, you're underwriting it just because the sponsorship dollars attached to him in the Japanese and Asian market, you know, he's going to bring with him at least $10 million yearly in revenue, and we're talking about lost revenue, because of all those sponsorship and partnerships you can create if you're the team that has Shohei Ohtani. So whatever you end up paying, just subtract at least 10 from the start, because that is going to come in from all the marketing opportunities you'll have with him. But it'll be fascinating to see how much money he's actually able to secure on the open market when he gets there next season.
Hey, if Ohtani actually puts on a Cubs uniform is here, imagine Marquee Sports Network doesn't have to try to insult you with all positivity in the postgame.
Oh.
Because there'll be actually, you know, good things to talk about and feel good. You won't have to listen to contrived. Well, you remember that hit in the third inning, even though they lost 10-2? That was pretty good.
Remember,
right?
That run? When the run, the Cubs jumped out to a 1-0 lead? Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome, Chris Farley. Yeah. That they better be in that conversation no matter. It's 500, 600. You know, make sure the sports book is spitting out tickets and they're getting their take of that.
Yeah. Meanwhile, on the south side of town, everyone I'm talking to, I was chit-chatting with Jesse Rogers. He was upstairs in the ESPN 1000 offices the other day on Friday. He had to pick up some equipment for ABC7. He's going to be doing some work for them, as he usually does. And we were just talking a little bit, and he was saying, man, everybody I'm talking to around baseball is not very excited about what the White Sox have put together. Lots of people, very, very, they're very down on what the White Sox are bringing to the table so far.
Well, I saw, MLB.com gave grades out, off-season grades to all the teams, mm-hmm. and I believe they did not get a passing grade. There are no Bs or B pluses or A minuses for what transpired in the off-season, Mike Clevenger notwithstanding. It's all about Pedro Grifol, and it's all about bounce back years and, you know, Yoan Moncada being what we think he could be and what he has been years ago. And it was interesting to hear what Jose Abreu told Steve Greenberg of the Sun-Times. I mean, he said we weren't a family last year, and he seemed to talk about not even being, you know, look, I had no problem with the White Sox moving on from Jose Abreu at his age,
mm-hmm.
but he felt disrespected, and he sounded like he was anxious to get out of Dodge because of all the things that weren't going right on and off the field. Sound like, you know, when you land with a World Series contending team, what they've been in three of the last 4 years, the Astros.
And isn't it like six straight ALCSs for the?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way to end your career.
Yeah.
So, believe me, Dusty Baker's happy to have him, and he's happy to have to found a landing spot that gives him a legitimate opportunity to finish up in the correct way.
I had no problem with the White Sox parting ways because, as you said, his age, it just didn't seem, you know, prudent to spend big money on him. The problem I have is that, you know, you need Andrew Vaughn now to live up to the hype of him being the third overall pick in his draft class. And then when you go and, you know, Andrew Benintendi, who's been hitting third a lot in spring training, and Pedro Grifol did say he kind of likes him there, which, I don't know, he seems like much more like a number two hitter to me. I'd much rather have his on-base percentage ability in that two spot, but as opposed to number three. But we'll see how that plays out. I don't love, though, hearing that he could be your three hitter for a significant amount of games this season. I have to be honest there, because replacing Jose Abreu, it's going to be difficult enough. I'm not sure Benintendi's the guy who's going to be your run producer in that lineup.
Yeah, and I'm with you. I was moving on from Jose Abreu just because of where the Sox are and you know, currently what their prospects appear to be. It's going to take a lot to go right for them to win that division. But I don't know how that resonates around the league. If he felt, you know, if he tells people he didn't feel respected in terms of free agency, and how, maybe we can talk about that after the break, because the Bears have got, mm-hmm. like every team in the NFL, got a report card from their own players. And ultimately, it comes down to how much you're going to pay me and for how long.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things that, you know, players talk to each other about. Hey, you know, is this a good place to play? If not, why not? And, you know, guys share some stuff, you know, before games, after games, you know, whatever, meeting up for a beer. And sometimes there's a reason the Bulls are not attractive to free agents and haven't been for a long time. And ultimately it's winning and money, but there are other things that come into play.
Sounds good. You mentioned it, the Bears report card. And I have a question for you, Bri. What do Lululemon, Meghan Markle, and Will Smith have in common?
Oh, boy.
I'll tell you next.
Listen to us now, live on the ESPN Chicago app. This is Chicago's home for sports. ESPN Chicago.
As we went to break, I asked Brian Hanley, and I'm Jeff Meller, by the way, here on ESPN 1000. We're here till 11. I asked Bri, what do Lululemon, Meghan Markle, and Will Smith have in common? Brian, do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
Well, I am aware of everything. I don't own any Lululemon apparel.
Okay.
I'm aware of the former royal. And, of course, yeah, I know. I can't make the connection, but I'm aware of the three subjects involved.
Well, you did very well there laying it out. They were all the ire of Chris Rock in his stand-up special yesterday, Selective Outrage, which debuted on Netflix, and it went live last night, which is the first time Netflix has done a live broadcast of anything. So it's now available on Netflix. It occurred, but Chris Rock finally, just shy of a year, finally responded to the Will Smith slap from the Oscars last year. He finally had his day, and it was absolutely, figuratively and literally, a mic drop as he concluded the show, dropping the mic. And he spent the first hour or so, you know, pontificating on Lululemon, amongst plenty of other things, also Meghan Markle, and finally did a 10 minutes on Will Smith, where it will be interesting to see how Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith respond, if they respond at all, because, you know, it was simmering for just shy of a year, and Chris Rock did not hold back, I will tell you that.
Well, I remember watching that in real time, and mm-hmm. people on Twitter are like, what was that? I tweeted out, I believe, assault.
Yes.
Because people thought it was staged and everyone was in on it. And I was like, nah, that was definitely not something that was planned.
And I'll tell you, he did not hold back. And as I mentioned, it was Netflix's first live showing of anything. What was interesting to me, they had a pregame show for Chris Rock's comedy special.
Oh, boy.
They had a post-game show. And let me give you, before we get to the Bears report card to close this out, the post-game show for the Chris Rock Netflix special, Selective Outrage, was hosted by David Spade and Dana Carvey with panelists Arsenio Hall, J.B. Smoove, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
How much money did they put in this?
I mean, listen, it's Netflix. It seems like they will spare no expense when it comes to their content, although that has changed over the last year or so. But it was odd to hear. I mean, it wasn't bad, but to have David Spade and Dana Carvey and Arsenio Hall, J.B. Smoove, breaking down the stand-up that they had just watched like it was a Bulls or Hawks game.
That's
crazy. Really, really weird, and it was. I don't know if I would normally do it, but it was an interesting experience. I will say that.
I thought the Bill Cowher take was the most relevant.
Yes.
Yeah.
No. So it was interesting. It's worth your time to check out if you haven't seen it. Chris Rock's new special on Netflix, Selective Outrage. He responds to the Will Smith slap. All right. The Bears were graded, Bri, by the NFLPA, and they finished 13th among 32 teams in the NFL. Which is, I'll give them, that's pretty solid, actually. I'll give them credit for that. You know, they're not in the bottom half. That is good. Although I will say, I think they do actually owe a large deal of credit to the fact that Ryan Pace actually, you know, renovated Halas Hall, because a lot of their good grades came from their brand new weight room and their training room and their locker room and their training staff up at Halas Hall.
Yeah, but the bad news for them, and this is a player's poll, and every team's players weigh in on their own organization. They got a D plus in food for lack of quality and healthiness. It's like the old joke: boy, the food there at that restaurant's terrible, and the portions are so small.
Yes.
And then they got a C minus in travel because they're one of seven teams that do not offer first class seating throughout the plane for everyone. Mm-hmm. And last time I checked, NFL big bodies, right?
Yep.
Not exactly the Blackhawks not chartering all those years when Chris Chelios had to sit next to an insurance guy trying to sell him a life policy. But those are little things that you think with the amount of money that's minted for NFL teams, they would be easily correctable. And I don't know if they're paying attention, but you're chartering, I think you can go ahead and get a plane that installs first class seating throughout the entirety of the cabin for the players who need that extra room.
Yeah, no doubt about it. The silver lining here is that maybe, just maybe, Kevin Warren, who for a long time was in charge of the Minnesota Vikings, well, even though he was over at the Big Ten conference as the commissioner there for the last few years, the Vikings actually finished first amongst NFL teams. So maybe, just maybe, Kevin Warren can help the Bears instill some of what was going on there. All right, that's it for us, Bri. We'll do it again next week if that sounds good to you.
Sounds great. Thanks, Jeff, for the it's always enjoyable, and I look forward to next week.
Thank you to Brian Hanley. Thank you to Kendra Smith, and thanks to Ben Pope as well. Keep it locked here. Tyler Aki and Shay Norling coming up with some NCAA hoops action next.